He spent most of his life at the English monastery Emrawati, very, very good monastery. But the last couple of years, he's been more floating, I'd suppose you would say. Venerable Amarantho likes to interact very much with the lay community and with especially young people, parents, all kinds of community. His practice is mainly based in a relationship situation, very much with the emphasis on mindfulness. And I'm very sure that he will give a good account of all that tonight. We've had the pleasure of having him here in Perth for the last 3 or 4 weeks. He's actually was at our at a camp that's where he looked after many people that came along and joined that camp. And we are hoping that in the future we'll be able to make some kind of a formal arrangement with him where he can come and visit here and stay here really as much as he likes, so that we can get the benefit of the wonderful wisdom that he has to impart to us. So without further ado, now I'll hand you over to Venerable Amarantho.
Thank you. Thank you. Very nice to see you here this evening. When I was coming here this evening, I always think Friday night, you know, Friday night in Perth, what's happening out there. People are getting ready to go out clubbing and disco. I remember those days very well. So my mind sort of wanders in those directions. Also, it's very nice to see Venerable Mudita here as well to be up here. Usually, when I do these things, I'm by myself, so it's very nice for him to sit there and be with me. Don't feel lonely. So, actually, I didn't really come to Perth to give a talk. Actually, so I'm totally partly surprised by this situation. I came to Perth because this is actually where my spiritual journey started off from, and I want to share a bit of that journey with you. The other thing I'd like to say is the style of the way that I've been taught about giving a public talk is that we just speak from the moment, right? So this is also part of this mindfulness. This is a reflection. So it's just to see, how does it affect you? Do you like it? Do you not like it? This sort of thing. So really just, so this is also sort of a continuation of the meditation. Just see, you know, you like my voice, you don't like my voice. You know, you like what I'm saying, you don't like it. Just like this. So it's not, but just a relaxed, open attention, just seeing how things affect you. So before I was a monk, I wanted to do the round the world thing, and I pretty much did that. And that's a long story, but I just want to tell you the story to Perth and a bit beyond. So I arrived in Sydney, and I liked hitchhiking. So basically, I walked out of Sydney Airport, and I stuck my thumb out and just kept going. So actually, I hitched all the way around Australia. I don't know how many miles that is, but it's a long kilometres. It's a long way round. And I started off in Sydney, and I didn't stay in the cities too much. I moved out to Canberra, came across the Nullarbor through absolutely amazing generosity of meeting somebody who said, I'll drive you across. So I had this 3-day trip, which was quite incredible, with the sun glaring in your eyes for most of the trip. I won't say what he was carrying in his car, but anyway, it was underneath my seat. yeah. And and I arrived in Perth with a little bit, or not really enough money. And I never really stayed in a backpackers or a hotel or a hostel or anything like that. I had a very small tent, very, very small tent, about this big, one-man tent. And I would just place my tent wherever I could. In Canberra, I lived in the central reservation. There's a road, and in the middle of the road, there's these trees, and I lived there for a little while. When I got to Perth, I can't remember exactly where I lived, but I went down to the beach, and I found a disabled toilet. and I lived in the toilet for a few days. So I started my ascetic practice early on, before I was a monk, actually. And I lived out of dustbins for food and this sort of stuff. So it was quite an interesting practice. So anyway, I got to Perth and thought, I need a bit of money. And basically, I looked through the newspaper and I saw an advert for telephone sales. You know, if you're desperate for money, telephone sales. Don't know what it was then. It's usually, you know, $8 an hour or something. Give yourself a yellow pages. You know, you get a pen, you tick it. Hello. Yeah, I thought, I can do that, no problem. So I didn't even put on a suit or a tie. I just walked into the office. I phoned up and said, I'll come down for an interview. They said, fine. Walked in there with my backpack and my shorts on. Said, I can do that, get a job. So they said, oh, no. Tell you what, we do this other thing. We do this thing called door knocking. You go and tap on people's doors. Do you fancy doing that? I said, I don't mind. I'll do whatever you want. I just need the money, really. So they said said to me, okay, so you start tomorrow morning, 10 o'clock. So this place was called Serinian House. I don't know if you know this place. This is a drug rehabilitation centre. Had a very, very good understanding of how to rehabilitate drug addicts. And they needed money, so they're charity, and I was collecting money for them and also getting a bit of money on the side, legally. We won't talk about the ethics, but anyway, or how much percentage I got. But anyway, I did pretty well out of it. And Australians really love my accent, so I used to just go to the door speaking, hello, my name is, I'm working on behalf of, ding, ding, ding. And then I got really good at it. I worked out, I had to make a lot of money out of it. I used to suss out cars, or I worked a lot on gut reaction, ran over fences. Basically, we just worked 10 till 3. And so anyway, I did all this, and I really didn't want to spend any money. So then I used to sneak back in the evening and sleep on the floor of this house, Serenian House. Of course, they caught me, you know. So, and one of the guys in there, he said, you know, why don't you come back and stay at my house? I thought, oh, yeah, okay, I'll do that. So I went back to his house in one of the suburbs, stayed in his house, slept on his couch. And he had a library, you know, and over the days read his books. And there was a very thin book in his library. I picked it out. It's about meditation. And I read it and thought, wow, this is really good stuff. And I said to him, you know, oh, I've been reading your book about meditation. I think it's really good. You know, when I go to India, I'm going to do that. He says, oh, you don't have to go to India. We've got a retreat centre here in Perth. Just go out in the, it's a little bit out in the bush. I'll organise it for you. The person that runs Serenian House, he's a meditation teacher. He teaches the mothers who are drug addicts to meditation and gets them off this course. I said, okay, I'll sign up. So I signed up, and actually I'd got enough money by that point. And I said, I'm gonna travel around for a little bit until the meditation course started. So I hitched out, and I hitched to Kalgoorlie. I wanted to see what the gold mine looks like out there, see that wild little town. So that was a real eye-opener for me, going out all around that area. I think there's a place called Wave Rock or something, as I remember. It was a long time ago. And so I went out there, went out to Kalgoorlie. I'm hitching out of Kalgoorlie. This truck pulls up, big truck, says, can you drive a truck? I said, of course I can drive a truck. No problem. He says, well, get in. I need a truck driver. So I get in. He gets out, drives the truck. It's a bit like crunch, crunch. So anyway, there I am, drive down to a gold mine. It's a drilling rig. He says, I'll give you a job, $800 a week. You can work for me. You do 6 weeks straight, go and have a break, come back again. $800 a week, flipping out, that's a lot of money. And something in me said no. He said, I want to go back and do that meditation course. And on a rational level, of course, I couldn't work it out. I thought, you know, money's damn good. I'm not going to spend it on anything. Well, I probably spent it on beer, anyway. you know. And it said, no, I've got to go and do that meditation course. And as part of this sort of journey, I think back from Kalgoorlie, as far as I can remember, I went into one of the information centres, the tourist information centre, and said, you know, what are good places to see around this area? They said, oh, you should go and see Serpentine Dam. So I went down to Serpentine Dam, saw it. I thought, oh, very nice. Slept on the picnic table there. I recommend it. And then you have these, they had these like electric cookers or something like that. Fry up a steak or something, have it. And anyway, so I thought nothing of it, hitched back to Perth. And I did this 10-day meditation course with this Indian teacher called Goenka. He is not actually there, he does it by video. But I was there and did this course 10 days, really serious meditation, 12 hours a day. You sit in 1 or 2 hours slots all day long, early morning to late at night. And there's a little video in the evening. I was sitting there in my shorts. I was thinking. And they kept coming up to me and saying, why are you so happy? I said, well, this is fantastic. This is what I've always been looking for. I listened to the talks. I said, of course, it makes total sense to me. I said, you know, you're sitting so long, aren't you in pain or something? Said, yeah, a little bit, but this is what I always wanted. And they couldn't understand it. But I was just as happy as anything. Had my little room, 10 days in silence, nothing for me. I'd been already travelling a few years. And then this very scientific teaching about how to understand oneself, which was really what I was looking for. The reason I was hitchhiking, the reason I started hitchhiking was that I was so unhappy that I thought that there was no more happy people left in the world. So I thought, I'll experiment with this. And in England, I experimented with it. I just walked out the front door from my parents' house. I walked out the door one day and I hitched as far as I could go just to see if there was somebody that would be friendly, kind, generous and pick me up. And lo and behold, it worked, you know. And then my adventures really started. It went on from one place to the next. But anyway, it got me around Australia and got me here and got me on that meditation course. I thought, this is wonderful. And then they said about the five precepts and being vegetarian. I thought, makes total sense to me. I'll just do that. And then they say at the end of the course, please practice meditation every day. I was thinking. And firstly, I thought, I've got to stop my travelling and I've got to start doing this. But then my craving for travelling was so big that I couldn't stop it. There was so much energy in it. So I finished this course, got back, hit the road again. And when you do these meditation courses, your mind really calms down and your taste buds become very sensitive. You taste, like tasting an orange is like an explosive experience, you know, or any food. It's just incredibly, the senses are so sensitive. So I come out of this course, I hit the road, start hitching, and I start meditating every morning. I get up on the side of the road, sit in my little tent, do me 1 hour in the evening, 1 hour in the evening, and I start following the precepts. It just seems natural to me, really. And so anyway, I go up the whole of the coast, Broome, and out to the mountain, Augustus or something, this big rock, and then up, I hitched halfway along the Gibb Road, and then I hit Darwin. I wanted a lift in one of those big lorries, those with the three trailers. So I spent a long time on the side of the road, and I was at outside some bar somewhere between Carnarvon and Darwin, and I just basically begged the driver, right? And I said, "Oh, please give me a lift. I've come all this way. I just want a lift. You just have to drop me off at the other end and I'll be fine." So anyway, he gave me a lift. Actually, he had a degree in psychology. We had this incredible talk. But so anyway, I arrive in Perth and then I hitch down all the way down through the middle down through Alice, Kings Canyon, all this sort of stuff. And there's a fantastic walk, I really recommend it, out from Alice, out on this ridge. It's about 3 or 4 days. And I'm walking out there, and I can't remember. It's funny, this has just come to me. But I've come to a gorge there, and I'm walking up the gorge, and there's a Tibetan monk in a cave, right, with a two lay women sitting there. He's meditating, you know. And I couldn't believe it. And it just, the first thing that arose to me is dana, you know, generosity. I want to give this monk something. I can't actually even remember what I gave him. Maybe I gave him some food or money or something or other. But there it was, a Tibetan monk in the middle of nowhere. My God. So anyway, so I do this. And I hitch back all the way down. I think it comes out somewhere near Adelaide or that way. Hit Port Augustus. Very lovely little town. And then I decide that I'm going to go back along a dirt road. So I travel on, I can't remember, it's out near the Flinders Ranges. And I hitch down this dirt road. And I meet this, I don't know if you know this person, he's quite famous, he's called Talc Alf. He lives in the middle of nowhere, he carves talc, crazy, well, I shouldn't say crazy guy in case he's listening. But anyway, he's really interesting guy. And he picks me up and he says, do you want a job? There's a talc mine up here, maybe we'll get you a job. Yeah, okay, why not? So anyway, go out the talc mine, come back, it doesn't work out there. He says, but there's an English guy running a farm here. You know, one of these stations, maybe you can go out there. I'm thinking, that's really good. That'd be what an experience. That'd be working on a big ranch. So we rock up to this ranch. There's a English guy running this running this ranch. And I think he said, or I said, well, can I stay for a while? He said, yeah, sure. I said, you know, I'm vegetarian. You know, like your sheep and cows. So I've not come here to harm animals. I don't drink either. Said, yeah, okay, I'll give you the experience. So actually I stayed on this, became a cowboy, and I stayed on this farm for about 4 or 5 months. And you know how these places are. This place was the size of England. That's a really big place, no neighbours. Had an airstrip, a helicopter. Learned to ride a motorbike, fix windmills, horses, sheep, 30,000 sheep, the second biggest shearing shed in probably South Australia, 20 stations. So I learned to shear sheep, all this sort of stuff. And it was an absolutely amazing experience for me, really amazing experience. But after a while, the culture of that and working in that environment, it got to me a bit, and I'd really had enough. So this guy, he drove me down the road, said, okay, I'll drive you to the end of the road, you can hitch again. So he drove me down to the end of the road, and there was a pub, and I'd been keeping the 5 precepts on the dot. He said, there's a pub, why don't you come in? Let's celebrate, you've been here for some time. I went into the pub. 1 drink, 2 drinks, lots of drinks, too many drinks. So from the pub back to the property is about 30 miles, 40 miles. I think we drove backwards for 40 miles. So I was sick as a dog, as you are. And a whole different journey unfolded. And so I started eating meat. Actually, and then I ended up killing animals. So probably most of you know this, but for a little English boy from suburban London, it was quite an experience. And I think also, you know, working with young people in the way that I do, I really start to now understand what I wanted. That was partly, I needed that experience, right? Actually, part of me wanted to kill something. And so I went and killed a cow with a double-barrel shotgun at very close range, and then slit the throat of the cow, skinned it, dropped it, dropped the guts, hang it up, cut it all up, ate it. So quite a big experience. And anyway, I stayed on this farm for a little while, had my time there, hitched all the way back. And afterwards, there was this natural reflection going on. I didn't know it at the time. I didn't know it was this sort of language. But there was actually, meditation was really happening naturally all the time. So the interesting thing was, by the time that I got to Darwin, which was I was going to fly to Timor and then island hop all the way through Indonesia, which I did. By the time I got to Darwin, actually, I realised I didn't want to do any of that. So actually, I had my last meat pie and my last beer in Darwin. That was it after that point. I never drank after that, and I've been vegetarian pretty much ever since. So it's been, and there's been a whole journey of me becoming, there was a whole energy of me becoming a monk through that, through that whole experience of meditation and me arriving in England, and I lived in a meditation centre for a few years, and then this absolute calling to become a monk, and ended up on the doorstep of Amravati and saying, I want to become a monk, and when can I ordain? And I basically never left there pretty much for, 10 years, lived that lifestyle. But the reason I say this story is that I was running a young person's retreat in Malaysia just recently. And I say, because of my experience of working on the farm, I ask that all the retreats that I run are vegetarian. And there was this... so we have this retreat. It was the first day. They're big retreats. There's 50 kids. There's a lot going on. There's lots of helpers. And we come to the evening meal, and they'd had meat there. And something in me just exploded. Very interesting, This whole app just, wow, rage. And I had to really stop myself. I went away, calm myself down, breathe, and really allow it to calm down, myself to calm down, and then be able to go back later on and say, prefer it not to happen, and this is why. So this is the way, habits get formed, how experiences really condition us, and how when we come into relationship, even years and years later on, how they can affect us, But with this, what I call this practice of, awareness, of opening up, really receiving, being with the present moment, then one can really catch these habits, because these habits, generally, they're formed in relationship. Yeah, so the more that we can bring our practice, more bring this awareness, this mindfulness into whoever we're dealing with, we can really be much more peaceful, much more responsive to the situation. So, now, being outside the monastery and also working with families and young people, you can't do all this meditation. They're too fidgety. They like their movement. But that doesn't mean that you have to lose mindfulness. It doesn't mean that you have to, react to those situations. You can start to really notice your own stillness. Be with that. Yeah, and it gives you the ability to really notice how these emotions come up in yourself and can really, they can really grab you. And even when they grab you, they don't have to overwhelm. They don't have to overwhelm. And then this gives us the point of really we can start to choose how we want to live, how we want to respond to the situation. So for me, the Buddha Dhamma, the Buddha means awareness, Dhamma the truth, how to be aware is to really start to really notice what do you really need. Yeah, not what you want, but what do you really need? Yeah, do you need to be, like I was encouraging when we start in the meditation, do you need to be more comfortable? Do you need to find a better position to sit? Yeah, or sitting on chairs, same thing, So this really, this ability to listen, because I work a lot in secular society, where you can't use meditation words so much. So I like to use the word listen. Yeah, just this quality of listening. So really, you know, just having this real willingness to just listen to what's going on, listen to yourself. And I've, as you can probably guess, I got a really busy mind, right? I can do lots and lots of different things at the same time. If you know this other spiritual practice called the Enneagram, it's a way of defining your personality. I'm the one that's the adventurer, and you know, I can think 10 different things at once and all the rest of it. But that's just the nature of whatever, the karma that I came in with, the way that I was brought up, whatever it is, right? So I need to work with that. So I have to work with a lot of thinking. I got a lot of thinking going on. And if I really try, you know, we think we have to really control the mind or really make it silent. But for a lot of us, you know, we've been through this really, this educational process, which allows, it is about discrimination, isn't it? It's about splitting. It's about one thing's better than another, or categorizing. But, and for me, how can we include all those thoughts? So I've really trained myself to allow those thoughts just to come and go, to be with them. Because it's very, you don't suffer if you're with those thoughts. You can't suffer. Suffering only comes if you think about it, isn't it? Suffering happens if you've got a voice in your head. You know, one voice says, la, 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 la. I'm doing the puppets now with the children. Anyway, you've got a voice. You've got a voice here. This voice goes, la, 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 la. This voice goes, la, 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 la. Yeah, there's still two voices. One says, you know, suffering. The other one says, be happy. The other one says, be happy. The other one says, no, you should suffer. Isn't it? Critical voice or parental voice or whatever it is. So I've developed a way of just having a conscious relationship with these voices. Sometimes you need to negotiate with them, you know. So you need to say, well, you know, you can't speak right now. You know, I wouldn't want a critical voice in my head right now. Please don't come in. So it's really this ability to really listen to these voices. You know, for me, somebody who's insane is somebody that doesn't listen to their voices. Yeah. So because I've got so many voices in my head, I have like an inner conductor. It goes, you. You know, or we see work with what's the prominent one, right? And then once you have this relationship, actually they calm down by themselves, isn't it? It's like I like working with kids a lot. You know, why when we got a baby, we all go in the room and everyone goes, oh. Why is that? We look at a young little baby and go, oh. Actually, because they're not making any judgment. They're just with you, aren't they? They're totally present. They don't know that they're present. This is the gift of being human, isn't it? This is the gift of the ego. The ego allows us to recognize the present moment. It allows us to capture that. It's a bit of a painful journey, I found in my own experience. I'm now 43 or 4. God. Anyway, and although they say women have midlife crisis, men have it too as well. I can guarantee, hands up, me, yes. So around 40, I felt like I just woke up from a dream. Really amazing dream. Like I've been on some sort of pre-programmed journey. Really. And now there's this sense of, wow, there's all sorts of different options available. And actually also a sense of complete and utter meltdown. So it's been a very interesting experience leaving a monastery. You know, I've never been one for institutionalisation. So I never got quite institutionalised, but you could say I developed a few habits. Or a few habits got inside me or something like that. So being outside the monastery and then being more in community, sense of support and all these different things. Really interesting to see how all these, what we call sankharas, these past formations just bubble up. And I can tell you some of the times been totally overwhelming. And then having, of course, this is normal lay life. you know all about this much better than I do. But for me, it's, you know, very different experience. So really learning how, I've been really learning, you know, how to work with this, and how do I work with it? Actually, I'm just really willing, I'm really up for listening and learning from it. Even when I really do not like it and I'm falling apart and I can't even meditate, I can't even get myself on the cushion. So I've been very fortunate, and I was allowed a three-week retreat in Bali. I'd just been to Bali, and I Googled on the internet and I found a nice retreat centre, and it was a very lovely retreat centre, very, very lovely. And I sent them an email. I said, could I come over and do a little retreat? Be really nice. I said, sure, we'll pick you up at the airport. Wow. So they picked me up at the airport. They drive me 2 hours outside of Denpasar. Up into a very lovely area where there's a volcano. And this wonderful retreat centre, marble from top to floor, cool, lovely room, wonderful shrine room, multi-million dollar view right over the lake. He says, I did tell you about the noise from the trucks. Oh, no. So anyway, go to bed that night, wake up, meditate, sort of hearing this noise. Okay. Have breakfast, go back, hear this noise. And I start smelling the air, oh, full of diesel. Oh, it'll be all right. I think, no problem. I'll just get up earlier. I'll get up at, you know, 2 or 3 in the morning. I'll meditate till 6 or something like that. I'll be all right. Wake up at 2 or 3 in the morning and diesel. You're a monk, Renato. Come on, it's just an object. It's just a sound. Leave it there. Yeah, come on, get on with your practice. Okay, sit now. Come all the way to Bali. Could have done this in London. Come on, relax. Soften that up. It's all right. It's all right. It's all right. Calm down. Breathe. Soften the belly. Breathe. I got all the instructions. I tell you, I got a whole toolkit to deal with it. But actually, I was really upset. And so I really listened into this, and I thought, okay, don't just stay with it. Stay with it. So first day, stay with it. Second day, still upset. And then I realised a lot of my life, I've always been a yes person, partly. Always said, yes, okay, no problem, I'll do that. I'll do this, I'll do that. No problem, yeah, sure, of course. But no, sometimes. How about if I really look after myself? And Renato, what would you really like? You would like to be in a quiet place, by yourself, without diesel fumes and noise of trucks. That's what you really want, isn't it? Yes. Okay, good. Sorted that one out. Thank you. So go and tell the guy. Oh, I can't tell the guy. I'm a monk. He'll be upset. And he's organised it for me. And okay, go back and sit. And then it just came to me. It actually came to me, no. Just like that, no. No is no. 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 And just got up. Said to him, sorry, it's not working. We need to find somewhere else. So he took me to a little place up the road. That place was okay, didn't quite work. And they said, why don't you go to this other monastery? It's at the top of Bali. I said, sure. Here's the money, get on the bus. Put me on the bus, paid the bus driver. Go from one place to the next. Arrive in this place, they make the phone calls, phone up this monastery, no problem. Arrive there, put me in a room in the front, and this is quite a touristy, you might know about it. It's a very lovely place, but it's got this very big stupa there. Not Borobudur, but Borobudur, one of the stupas from it. And so I get there, and it's full of tourists, and I think, oh my God, I come all the way to Bali now, and all these tourists are going to say and ask me about Buddhism and God, and I, no, I'm not doing that. So I do the, you know, dive, make sure. I work it out. I'm very skillful with these things. When you live in a monastery like this and you get a lot of tourists, you work it out what time they come and what time they don't come. So then you sneak out, go and get your food, come back. I think this... Anyway, there for a few days, and they said, okay, you can move to the back of the monastery. We have a very nice little retreat centre there. You can have a room, set me up in this really lovely room, come and stay. They said, you do know it's the anniversary of the monk that built this place, and there's a big ceremony happening tomorrow. okay. Breathe, Amranato. Anyway, so there I am. At this ceremony, and he says, you do know that we've got 10 relics here. 10 relics. So I do this again, offer a guided meditation with a translator who's fluent in Indonesian and English. And anyway, so after that, it all calms down. I'm in my room. I just get a few knocks on the door from people wanting to speak, but basically, I have a 3-week retreat, very, very silent. And really just. And my practice is this one of really just sitting there and being with whatever is and just really allowing all this sort of stuff. And I noticed this edge of depression coming up. And then it became much more. And then you do the... sit a bit like this. I just really lean into it. So I was just started to sit like this, and then actually I decided, no, I'm not going to sit like this. I'm going to sit on a chair on the balcony. So I'm sitting there on the balcony, really unhappy. I'm in the middle of Bali. I'm at a wonderful temple. I'm getting food twice a day delivered to my door. You're so bad, and the voice in the head. And then I just look up in front of me. I'm sitting in front of jungle. Jungle doesn't complain. Trees just grow, don't they? The water, the rain just comes down, the trees just grow, the leaves come on the tree, there's this abundance. Nature is just abundant, isn't it? Like we did this Nanga bush camp last weekend, just in the fresh air, trees. It's not arguing, they're not arguing with each other, they're just getting on with life. So I look up there and think, abundance there, suffering here, abundance there, suffering here. So you're going to, Amranato, you're going to limit yourself to here. Do you really want to do that? Or do you want to expand to here? Do you want to expand into abundance? Which would you like to do? Oh, no, I think I'll suffer. So, I don't want to do this anymore. Why do I want to do that? This is the world, nature is not doing that. So I just choose abundance. Suffering disappears, peace arises, go back to sitting. So anyway, I finish the retreat, I go back to Seminyak. I don't know if any of you have been to Bali. I mean, I know there's a lot of Australians go to Bali on holiday. Seminyak is an interesting place. So I stayed in Seminyak for a few days. And Seminyak is a very touristy place. I was very lucky to meet somebody there. There was a temple there I could stay with for a few days and met with this wonderful Buddhist sculpture person. She stayed at his house for a day. And I'm going all around Seminyak, and there's Buddha rupas, Buddha images everywhere. There's shops called Buddha... swimwear or something like this, Buddha bar, or I don't know, there's Buddha everywhere. But can you find any Buddhism in the place? Can you find any stillness? Can you find any quiet? Not one bit. It's totally amazing. I've found some amazing, beautiful, large, wonderful Buddha rupas. You really feel just the beauty of them, you just want to pay respects to them, not, just out of how amazing it is a person could carve such a thing. But was there any Buddha? Was there any Buddhism there? Was there anybody being aware? Couldn't find it. Other than in the temple that I was staying with, a few other places. Everybody else is just hula, hula, hula. And there's endless massage places and this therapy and that therapy. Surf therapy. And I went in a few shops. They say, you're walking around a lot. I didn't think monks walked around these type of areas. So anyway, there I was. You know, and then come to Perth, come here, and then this whole cycle starts again. And really, you know, I came here to offer a young, you know, partly a young person's retreat, because I just wanted to have a lot of gratitude for, if you like, the Perth area, for what it offered me, because it completely changed my life, who I am. You know, in fact, I don't know who the person is that was travelling anymore. That person has changed so much, so much. And it's so just totally amazing to be back here and then offer this retreat in the bush and be here this evening, really. I just feel incredible gratitude. It's also why I went to Malaysia as well, because I was also offered on all these different areas. Wherever people have given me generosity, I felt to go back as a monk and try to offer something back to that community, to that group of people. You know, and generosity and kindness, not only outward but inward, is such a foundation. You know, being really kind to oneself, not beating oneself up, but really making friends with yourself. Really making friends with yourself, and finding the tools, finding the Buddhist word is upaya, skillful means, in order to heal yourself, to be fully alive, to be with all your energy. You know, to really reclaim all that. So I've worked on many different levels, you know, both meditation and therapy and all sorts of different techniques. Because sometimes meditation doesn't quite do it, not for me personally. And I've had to work on these the personality level, you know, because like running the family camp, this family camp I run is in England, has 100 people, 10 helpers. That's a lot of people to look after. And it's full on for 8 days. And my personality is a little... I got a fast mouth. And so sometimes it's very easy for me to go... And I've had to train myself and learn, you know, I've learned things, a better way of speaking to people, a better way of being able to express my feelings. But it's come through awareness and mindfulness first. First being aware of what's happening in the body and really knowing, and then being clearly able to express what's going on. You know, I'm angry because I need to understand what's going on. That's different from just saying, shut up and do what I say. That's a different level of it. You know, people respond in a very different way. And this takes time and patience and willingness, you know, real willingness. So your willingness to come here on a Friday evening, to give up a Friday evening, yeah, not only just to be here and listen to me and us, but also the willingness to nourish yourself. Yeah, you know what you're really looking for. You know it deep in your heart. And are you really willing to give it to yourself? Not tomorrow, not next week, but actually now. Are you really willing to have all your energy? All of it? It's just a matter of rocking up and saying yes. Just say yes to it. Yes to your illness, yes to your sadness, your grief, your happiness, your joy, all of it. No. The reason I work with teenagers is because they're really honest. When they don't like something, they just walk out. I love it. I just love it. None of us would do that, you know. If you're bored right now, would you just get up and walk out? The little voice in their head says, don't do it. We're going to be seen. Like, go on, do it, do it. Young person, they'll just get up, just walk out. Don't like it. Great. It means it's not working. Fine. So it's not working. So what do I need to do to make it work? It's great. You know, They're tired, they just go. They're excited, they share their energy. Same with kids, isn't it? You know, little kids, they're great. They just wander around, bundle of energy, scream, ah, quiet, peace. Us adults, nope, can't do that. I was once at an airport, going to the airport, there's a little kid looking out the window like that, lying on the floor. I think, oh God, I really want to do that. But they'd lock me up, wouldn't they? They'd lock me up. They'd say, no. He's a monk. Come here. No way. I thought, go on, do it, Amranath. No, I can't do it. But kids are really like that. And that, so that spontaneity and play, really encourage in your practice. Look at kids. Look at the way that they play. No, we passed a little kiddies room next door. I don't know if they are. I'd rather be in there, to be honest, playing with a Lego. But here I am giving a talk. But it is this sense of playfulness. So, allow that back in your life. You know, some of you may already have it. Hopefully all of you, please. But really allow that back in. You know, and especially if you're a parent, you know, just notice what that does to you, because it's all in relationship. You're in relationship with them. So sometimes at that age, they will trigger your same age. So just to be with that. Anyway, I'm watching the time. It's Valentine's Day next week. I was going to speak about love, but obviously I didn't get round to it. But but this is all about love. But I read a quote in a book this week that I really liked. It said, love is seeing. Love is seeing. And I really like that. And my real wish is that you actually see each other and you see yourself. That's real love for me. At 40, you go all soft in the head. Well, for me, I go soft in the head and like poetry. And I can't remember poetry, but I like to read you a poem just to finish off with. So if you excuse me, I'll read a poem. Oh, you get two poems. Okay. So this is from Hafiz. Hafiz is a Sufi, wonderful poet. How did the rose ever open its heart and give to this world all its beauty? It felt the encouragement of light against its being. Otherwise, we all remain too frightened. How did the rose ever open its heart and give to this world all its beauty? It felt the encouragement of light against its being. Otherwise, we all remain too frightened. This one's called Sweet Darkness. This is my favourite part. When your eyes are tired, the world is tired also. When your vision is gone, no part of the world can find you. It's time to go into the dark, where the night has eyes to recognise its own. There you can be sure you are not beyond love. The dark will be your home tonight. The night will give you horizon further than you can see. You must learn one thing. The world was made to be free in. Give up all the other worlds except to the one which you belong. Sometimes it takes the darkness and the sweet confinement of your aloneness to learn anything or anyone that does not bring you alive is too small for you. When your eyes are tired, the world is tired also. Probably enough for this evening. Thank you very much for your attention and kindness. Thank you. So, what do I... I've got some technical thing. Install something. Open Safari. What do I... Do I press... You'll be prompted to restart your Mac. This is all... Do I... Aha! Oh, I love it. It's all happening. So blank screen and... there's somebody from Sri Lanka. Dear Venerable, when you have a bad habit and you know that it's a counterproductive or unskillful, but you don't seem to stop yourself to change, what can I do? When you have a bad habit and you know that it's a counterproductive or unskillful, but you don't seem to stop yourself to change, what can I do? So I would really turn it into a friend. You know, when we use this language of trying to, like, it's counterproductive, we already have this tendency to push it away. Whereas my sense is really just learn and just accept it for what it is, because in the middle of that bad habit is actually a good habit. It's a bit like, you know, Ajahn Chah used to say about, like, barriers on the side of the road, they just keep pushing you back into the middle. So first learn about the habit by really being friends with it. Yeah, it doesn't mean you actually have to do it. You just have to know why you're doing it. And then something else can come out of it. For me, the experience of, you know, like I was talking about breaking the precepts, I'm not encouraging to do that, but just this sense of there was something that happened afterwards with me which really said, no, I don't want to do it anymore. You know, like when I'm working with young people, I can't enforce precepts, right? You can't do that, right? But you can get them to be reflective and start to see cause and effect. And then they might choose to see that their behaviour doesn't really work. It's a very different approach. Okay, another one. I've never been to Perth, but talks like yours have changed my life. Oh, it's a comment. Okay, thank you. Yeah, thank you as well. Thank you for listening. How to communicate... Oh, Steve from Sydney. How to communicate compassionately, how to say things to people when they are in a different emotional state. What's the best way to hitchhike? So they're both related. I tell you why they're both related. Hitchhiking is a form of meditation, and if you don't center yourself, you won't get a lift, right? And it's the same with your emotional states. And if you want to communicate compassionately, first of all, get to know your own emotions. If you don't know your own emotions, if you don't know your own anger, your own hatred, your own greed, hatred and delusion, and all the other emotions that go together with it, jealousy, yeah, it really is very difficult to be with somebody else's jealousy. I was saying last night to the group, I can be with a lot of anger. You can be pretty much as angry as you want. Don't like violence. Violence not good. I don't want you to hurt me physically. But anger, you can do whatever you want, because I've been with my own anger. Right? So like MVC, nonviolent communication, Marshall Rosenberg is a really brilliant way of learning how to speak. But in the end, it becomes an intuitive response, which is that you learn to center yourself in your body and really listen. What is really needed? What do I really need to say in this situation? Yeah, what's the best way of dealing with this person? You know, is it better to walk away? Is it better to be with that? You know, how close do I need to be to that person? Do I need to give it space? You know, and when people are in different emotional states, they can resonate with our own emotional states, and then we get sort of double triggered. You know, and again, this sense of really developing mindfulness, developing a sense of, you know, the range of emotions and how they get triggered, gives you the ability to not respond to them. You know, and when you do, we all lose it now and again, right? The thing is, again, be kind to yourself. Yeah, and just use it as a learning opportunity. There is nothing, no situation which you cannot learn from. There's nothing, no difficulty. Even the most difficult situation, there's been some amazing people that have been really willing to be with these very difficult situations, this real, you know, suffering in their lives, and transform it. And it really comes down to saying yes. Yes, I'm willing to be with it. Okay. Is there any others, or that's pretty much it? Okay. Oh, yeah, sure. If there's a question in the hall, yep, sure, yep.
Yeah,
Mike?
Hi, John.
Hello.
Excuse me. It's regarding children,
yep.
Drug problems. Do you think that the problem we have with children's drug problems is that fact we don't listen to them? Listen to what they've got to say. It's a case of the children should be seen, not heard.
Thank you.
I think that's the problem.
So this is a really... Okay, I can say a lot about this. So one thing I think that is hugely important, as you said, is listening, right? What I have seen in all my thing is the teenagers are not listened to today, right? There's a very important thing to that, and that is that the teenagers is a new phenomenon. There was never teenagers. You know, this is actually the word teenager was really invented by Hitler. The Hitler Youth was really where teenagers started from. If we look back, you know, pre-industrialization, people were working. So we really haven't worked out how to work with teenagers, nor have we really developed an education system that really supports, I'm going off on a tangent here, but it's really important to me, that supports teenagers with their hormones in education, right? There's a little bit about it, you know. So there's been some research done, change desk heights for boys. If you change desk heights, you know, and you give them freedom in the room, their marks, and it's a single sex class, you get 50% better results, right? So that's one. That's just that side of it. So the drug side of it is everybody's looking for happiness. Yeah, drugs give you an incredible, what I call vertical experience. Yeah, they give you a real spiritual opening, if you like. But you can't integrate the experience. I haven't done drugs myself, but I've been around a lot of people that have, you know, and they talk about the walls melting and, you know, vibrations and goodness knows what else. Yeah, sounds, you know, like a lot of spiritual states you get from deep meditation. So you think, well, why not just do that? 50 pence afterwards. Back of the shed. But there's no way of really integrating that experience because there's no cosmology, right? There's no frame of reference, you know, because religion is such a dirty word, and it's also, you know, religious people have abused it so much that those structures have gone. We've lost our connection to symbology. You know, you just look at the Buddha Rupa and you just think it's a nice thing, but it's also a piece of what I call spiritual technology, right? If you learn how to use it. So kids just don't have that cosmology, so they can't place their experience. They don't know how to place it. There's no initiation, right? Initiation is happening in gangs, yeah, because we have to do it. Humans have to do it in some way or the other, yeah. I can go on a lot more, but it's a really important area, and the crux of it is really listening. You know, why is it? Why would a kid want to do drugs? Got to ask yourself that question first. You know, what's he trying to deal with, or not deal with? I had a kid. I just have to be careful how I frame this. So I was working with a kid somewhere, who was a member of a gang, you know, and. I was running a workshop for teenage university students and trying to explain, you know, sharing with them mindfulness in a creative way. And this kid afterwards telling me he was a member of a gang, and, you know, he told me it took 7 policemen to hold him down once when he exploded with his rage. And he said he felt completely peaceful at the workshop. You know, they're looking for peace. They know it's there in their being, just like you know it's there in their being, but they don't know how to act, they don't know how to do it. And there's no support for that, is there? Look around, you know, just see where are the adverts? What are the adverts pointing to? What's the media pointing to? It's not pointing to peacefulness, it's pointing to discrimination, you know, fighting against one another. You know, so a gift of really stillness and being with some, you know, being with these people, offering stillness is, for me, huge. And it's what my passion is. That's really partly what I'm, all I'm really interested in a way. Because I work in a really secular way. You know, I go into vocational colleges in England, which are like, you know, hairdressers, this sort of stuff. And the teacher says to me, watch out for Jill and Janet. You know, they're the ones. They're the ones with all the I say to the teacher, okay, fine. Would you just mind going to the back of the class? That'd be fine. I'd, you know, and just have this quality of listening, engage with them. And then, you know, they're all speaking about, you know, who am I? You know, the deeper questions of life. This is natural, you know, it's totally natural that life is just unfolding, you know, and you're willing to join in with it. If you don't join in with it, you suffer. That's my experience. Anyway, I it's my pet subject, so. And actually, if you want as well, on Sunday I'm running a couple of sessions, one for parents. And I'm willing to speak a bit more about this in detail. Anything else? Somebody? Yeah, somebody at the back there. Put their hand up. Oh, you've got the microphone.
Yeah. Venerable, I like the word you use, relationship. No?
Yeah.
Yeah, I understand it to mean that your relationship with your mind. Yep. Is that what it means?
Yes, relationship. Yeah, yeah, not only with your mind, but... Oh, go on, carry on, sorry.
Just yeah.
Yep.
And
listen,
you further mentioned that once you know or understand it, it helps to calm you down.
Correct.
I think that's beautiful.
Yeah. Yep. So, but it's also in relationship with whoever's in front of you. Whether it's your own reflection, your own projections, or whether it's somebody else. Because then that's also how you get to know yourself. You know... The willingness to really be. So, you know, in some ways, the Dhamma is a relational field. So when we're sitting in meditation, we're in relationship with ourselves. And then, you know, and your practice of going outside and being with other people and all the rest of it is you have to relate to one another. You know, so if you separate the practice, yeah, you're always going to struggle, right? So just whatever's in front of you, be with that. Get, you know, this sense of really knowing